Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Supreme Court's unexpected ruling upholding Obama's signature Affordable Care Act. First, John Dean joins us to discuss the legal reasoning behind the court's 5-4 decision. He is the former counsel to President Nixon and was chief minority counsel to the House Judiciary Committee and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States. Then Dr. Susan Wood joins us to discuss what the Affordable Care Act means for women and children who would have suffered most of the impact of its repeal. She is a professor of health policy and executive director of the Jacobs Institute for Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Then we'll hear from Paul Starr, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of sociology at Princeton University and was a senior advisor to the Clinton Health Plan and is the author of Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. We will discuss how the Affordable Care Act will be enacted in the face of Republican resistance and Mitt Romney's vow to repeal it on his first day in office. Then we'll speak with one of the leaders of a demonstration against Walmart opening a new store in downtown Los Angeles. Maria Elena Durazo, the Secretary-Treasurer of the LA County Federation of Labor, joins us to discuss why she and 10,000 protesters are marching to oppose Walmart, a retailing giant whose six heirs to the fortune of founder Sam Walton today own more wealth than the bottom 30% of Americans. Joining us now is John Dean, who is the former counsel to Richard Nixon and prior to that was chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the associate director of the Law Reform Commission, and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. Today, John Dean is a best-selling author of such books as Blind Ambition and Lost Honor, and more recently, Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, Conservatives Without Conscience, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive Legislature and Judicial Branches, and Pure Goldwater. He's also a columnist at Justia.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Dean.
Thank you, Ian.
And today is obviously a big day, a big surprise for most people. It's interesting that the punditry had predicted before the hearings, the public hearings in the Supreme Court, that there was no way in the world that they would strike down what's called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And then after the hearings, the ground shifted and most of the punditry thought they would just strip it all out and slap this president down. But big surprise today.
Well, it was for a lot, apparently. It actually was not for me. I tweeted several days ago that I thought that the court would do just about what they did. I joined the thinking of a couple people who are good court watchers, Tom Goldstein, who's with the Supreme Court blog.
SCOTUS.
Right. And Robert Reich, and I was, a number of good court watchers realized that Roberts really could not dare to do anything other than uphold the law. That being, had he not been confronted with, say, Bush v. Gore and Citizens United, which are two landmark cases that show pure judicial activism by the conservatives, he might well have come out 180 degrees away on this and not have reached out to find and support it. But he really was locked into a situation as the leader of the court where this is a court that he inherited that was losing ground in public approval and has slipped tremendously. And if they gave it another push, it could be at the tipping point with a case this big. And the court has no way to enforce its rulings other than its moral authority. It's based on logic and reasoning and not partisanship and ideology. So he really had no choice in my estimation. So I called it a couple days ago that I thought he would do pretty much what he's done.
But did it surprise you that Kennedy, who was considered to be the swing vote, voted with the majority? With the minority, I should say.
That did. But it's very interesting. I think what's happened as a result of that, it's no longer the Kennedy court. It's now the Roberts court.
So you think that he, Roberts, is basically thinking in terms of, a lot of people are saying he's thinking in terms of legacy, but you're thinking he's thinking in terms of restoring the public opinion towards the Supreme Court, given that a recent CBS New York Times poll found that 78% of Americans felt that this particular Supreme Court's justices make their rulings based upon personal political bias as opposed to judicial reasoning.
That is part of a broader poll. It shows the slipping public approval of the court as well. Americans don't want a partisan court. They don't want justices ruling by their ideology. They want them to judge based on the facts and the case and the law in front of them. And when you have a ruling like Bush v. Gore, where there's just absolutely no coherent reason other than the partisanship involved and what they did, and again in Citizens United, where they reached out and overreached, if you will, that's the kind of problem he was confronted with. So I think he did what he had to do, and not so much for his legacy, just he's going to be on that court a long time. He's a relatively young man. And if he doesn't want to see that court become totally irrelevant, where indeed it becomes a joke and its opinions have no weight at all, in fact, everyone will be trying to figure out some loophole they can get around them, then he's got to get that moral authority back. And that's what he's done with a ruling like this.
Again, I'm speaking with John Dean, who's a former counsel to President Richard Nixon, and prior to that was Chief Minority Counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the Associate Director of the Law Reform Commission, and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States. He's a best-selling author of a number of books, including Conservatives Without Conscience, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislature, and Judicial Branches, and Pure Goldwater. He's also a columnist at Justia, that's JUSTIA.com, and he Twitter's at John W. Dean. John, you're way ahead of me there, I'm afraid.
Oh, you've got to start tweeting.
I know, but I got a lot on my plate. You know, I basically have a staff of one, so compare that to the other programs that broadcast daily, you get an idea. But let's talk about what the Obama administration appears to have done right. And, you know, Obama is a constitutional lawyer. It looks like they had a kind of backup plan with the taxing authority. Most people thought that the individual mandate would be upheld because of the Commerce Clause, and then they changed their mind about it because it became the kind of the whipping boy in terms of all of the punditry. Do you think that they were wise to have that backup plan?
Well, that actually came up during the congressional proceedings. And that's one of the reasons they structured it as they did in the law. So I think, yes, it was very smart to have multiple theories. They also thought not only the Commerce Clause, but the Necessary and Proper Clause might well do the job. They had multiple arrows in their quiver, if you will, that they were firing. What is interesting, and one of the tips to me, was when I went back and looked at Robert's confirmation testimony, particularly his discussion of the Commerce Clause jurisprudence that would be relevant. It came up repeatedly during his hearing. Chuck Schumer, senator from New York, pushed real hard on concerned about some of the recent rulings of the Rehnquist court that he was going to, you know, he'd been a clerk on that court. He was something of a prize former law clerk of the Chief Justice, obviously a great admirer of Rehnquist. And so Schumer pushed us real hard on his feeling about the Commerce Clause and its impact. And what's also interesting is Roberts is very honest that he has questions about it and some of the landmark cases, and he won't buy into it. And so, in a sense, he telegraphed what he would do today in a number of ways in his confirmation hearings.
Well, we remember from his confirmation hearings, John Dean, that he said, I'll be the umpire, I'll call the balls and strikes, and I won't make up the rules.
And that's exactly what he ended up doing in this landmark case.
So it seems to be what's inherent in this Affordable Care Act, and people are still suggesting that there's still problems with it because of the individual mandate and the taxing authority, et cetera. But it would seem to me that what's fundamental here is that the American public are eventually going to come around, aren't they, to realize it's better to get insurance or face a fine. And there really wasn't ever any fines. There was never any liens involved in it. The best that the government would ever do would be take away your tax refund. So you'd have to be pretty ideological to refuse to join an insurance pool and to forego your tax refund, don't you think?
You would. It isn't a powerful, strong mandate or tax penalty, if you will. It's more of a just a reminder to get people to come in and play in the and be a part of the market, so that this, all these risks can be spread. I think that's probably going to be the enforcement of this law is going to be the least of the problem. I think educating the public about it is going to be the most important problem. If the Republicans can do to Obama what they've done to Obamacare, if you will, he's not going to be reelected. But I think they're getting with it now and beginning to explain, you know, the benefits of this law, what it will mean to people. And it has a lot of important things. You know, it 30 to 50 million people would otherwise be without insurance without this law. I think the president, you know, it was a very bold, not a terribly political move to push for this law. There's a lot of people who don't understand what's in the law. When they hear the separate parts of it, they poll well. When they get the overall polling on Obamacare, we don't want any part of that. Well, you know, being against health care is, to me, kind of sick. These are people who need help.
Right. Well, you know, the president today actually made a bit of a joke about that in his statement, John Dean, where he said, you know, this is not been a winner for him. He didn't do this for political reasons. He did it because he felt it was the right thing to do.
No, that's an act of leadership. When you bite the bullet and you know, he wasn't even for the mandate, as you recall. He was for the universal health coverage rather than, he would, in other words, basically expand Medicare and Medicaid to include everybody, and knew that wouldn't happen. So he bit the bullet and said, well, if this is this is all we can get, this is a wonderful starting point, which it is. You know, the United States is so far behind the rest of the world in health care, and you would think we'd be the leaders.
Well, Mitt Romney, of course, came out today and said that the first thing he'll do if elected president is repeal Obamacare. And he suggested it was a huge burden on the American taxpayer and on business, et cetera.
I caught both the president's and Romney's statement, and I was struck with how Romney doesn't seem to have looked at any of the facts, like the Congressional Bureau, a budget office, who has made a very clear nonpartisan analysis of this law, that it's not going to create deficits. To the contrary, it's going to help them. And the other representations that he made that this law puts the government between you and your doctor, that's just baloney. Someone was certainly going to call him on his statement today because it was laced with misinformation. But this has been a sad pattern of this candidate who has very little interest in the truth of what's going on, but rather trying to fearmonger, to pretend to take positions that are not viable. And while I suspect there is a small audience that follows that, I think that it'll finally get through to people that isn't what this is all about.
So, John Dean, do you think, though, that the Republicans can make an election year issue out of this? A lot of pundits are suggesting that Romney doesn't really want to run against Obamacare. He wants to run on the basis that he'll be the job creator. Already, Eric Cantor has in the House has scheduled a vote for July the 8th to again vote down Obamacare,
It'll go nowhere in the House.
Of course, I mean
the Senate will kill it. It'll just sit there, nothing will happen.
Well,
I think, how does Romney, who has Romney care, if you will, in Massachusetts from his years as governor, run against something that he once thought was good for the people of Massachusetts? It's a tough road. I think for a couple of weeks he will pound this drum for the base, but it's not a long-term winner. And the base alone can't get him elected.
Again, I'm speaking with John Dean, who's a former counsel to Richard Nixon, and prior to that was Chief Minority Counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the Associate Director of the Law Reform Commission, and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States. Today, John Dean is a best-selling author of such books as Blind Ambition and Lost Honor, and more recently, Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, Conservatives Without Conscience, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive Legislature and Judicial Branches, and Pure Gold Water. He's also a columnist at Justia.com. So do you think then that, is there going to be a backlash? I know this is a sort of political punditry question for the elections, which are sort of months away. But today in the House, they're going to vote to censure the Attorney General, the first time in American history that a cabinet office has been held in contempt. And of course, you know, he is an Attorney General, he's an African American. The whole thing is so trumped up, it's embarrassing to even talk about it. If you really look into it, Fortune magazine has done a very good analysis of what actually happened with the so-called Fast and Furious. Do you think that there will be a backlash to this kind of posturing and grandstanding that's going on?
I cannot imagine that the House in its behavior is winning friends and influencing anybody who's got any intelligence at all. This business with Holder is just pure political theater. It is shameful that the fact that the Speaker would schedule this and bring it to a vote is just lowers my estimation of this man even further than it was. I mean, at some point, it can go nowhere unless they think that the Sergeant of Arms at the House is going to go down to the Justice Department and arrest him and bring him up and imprison him in the Speaker's office. There's no enforcement mechanism because the way this is, it's referred to the Attorney General when there is a contempt of Congress. And the Attorney General is not going to enforce this against himself. It doesn't have to. There are exceptions in the law for this kind of situation. So it's pure show. And the House has never, not in the modern era, ever tried to enforce its own contempt situation. So that, you know, this and the vote on the health care, I don't know what people, how they can gain any respect. Some maybe they'll throw the incumbents out someday and start over.
Well, just in closing then, John Dean, just to return to the Supreme Court and the vote, Justice Anthony Kennedy, of course, was in effect replaced by John Roberts as the swing vote, as you mentioned, on this 5-4 court, that he says, in our view, the entire act before us is invalid in its entirety. He felt that that was his summary of his dissent, which he wrote. Interesting enough, though, the other dissenters, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, weren't that strident as they have been, and more recently in particular, Scalia was sort of went almost off the rails over the Arizona case, didn't you think?
He did, indeed. He was making personal political attacks against the president, taking on issues that weren't even in front of the court as to what he was doing with an executive order. It was just totally out of bounds.
Well, I thank you for joining us, John Dean. This has been a very interesting day, and I think if you're a supporter of President Obama, you have to say he had a good day, and Mitt Romney
I think Americans had a good day today.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with John Dean, who's the former counsel to President Richard Nixon, and prior to that was Chief Minority Counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the Associate Director of the Law Reform Commission, and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States. Today, John Dean's a best-selling author of such books as Blind Ambition and Lost Honor, and more recently, Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, Conservatives Without Conscience, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive Legislature and Judicial Branches, and Pure Goldwater. He's a columnist at Justia.com, and he twitters at John W. Dean. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back getting a perspective on what this Affordable Care Act will do for women. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Susan Wood, who's a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She's Professor of Health Policy and of Environmental and Occupational Health and the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute for Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Susan Wood.
I'm delighted to be here. It's a great day.
Well, I take it you're happy that the Affordable Care Act was upheld.
Absolutely, it's a wonderful ruling. It's obviously very complex and has a lot of legal issues raised. But the fact that the overall law was found constitutional and we can move forward in implementing it around the country is not just sort of a Washington thing, but actually something that's going to benefit people around the nation. So it's very good news.
But do you think the people around the nation will recognize the benefits? That's been one of the reasons why the Republicans have been able to demagogue this so-called Obamacare, mm-hmm. is because a lot of the benefits of it don't come in until 2014. And there's been something of a vacuum. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent in advertising to trash Obamacare. Do you think there's a way to sell this?
Well, I think it's really, you know, you're right that there is not as much awareness of the benefits that are in effect today as well as the benefits that are going to come in 2014. And there has to be a lot of work, and there has been, but it's been overshadowed by the questions around the legality or the constitutionality of the law. And I think now that that's been put to rest, we can move forward, not just in implementing what's going to happen in 2014, but in communicating to individuals and families and businesses and business owners that this actually has benefits now. The fact that preventive services are being covered without a copayment, the fact that children can stay on their parents' plans until they're age 26. The fact that seniors are benefiting through Medicare, better coverage of prescription drugs. These are all things that are in place now, and people start to recognize that you don't have to pay a copay when you go in for that mammogram. But they don't necessarily connect it to the fact that that came about because of the Affordable Care Act. And I think we need to do a better job of talking about that and letting people make that connection. But I also think now that we've moved past this very high-level, high-powered, and high-stress decision, people can focus on what do we need to do to improve our health care and our access to health care and the quality of our health insurance, which those who have insurance now certainly want to see better plans and better coverage.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Susan Wood, the former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She's Professor of Health Policy and Environmental and Occupational Health and the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute for Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. And I called you, Susan, because my understanding is that had this bill been repealed, the people who would have suffered most are women and children, and they are the least insured in this country. Of the, 40 to 50 million uninsured, they make up the majority. Is that right?
Well, in direct insurance, it's hard to say because women do have better access to Medicaid. For example, pregnant women get covered under Medicaid at a higher income level. But their insurance is more vulnerable to being lost. They're more likely to be dependent on their spouse, their husband's insurance, and therefore if they were divorced, they could lose that access to that insurance. They're more likely to be part-time workers, which doesn't come with any or very good insurance coverages. So they are more vulnerable to losing their insurance or to having poor quality insurance. But the reason the benefits of this, the healthcare law is, you know, it comes about in so many different ways. It comes about in the coverage of preventive services and specifically the preventive services for women, which haven't really kicked in yet. Those come into effect in August. And those are not in effect yet, but and would have been lost had the law been overturned. The expansion of Medicaid, which did get to have some limits placed on it by the court's ruling, is a real opportunity for both men and women to get coverage, regardless of, you know, they fit into a particular category of being pregnant or being disabled or being a parent of a child, small child. These are things that they no longer will have to meet those criteria. If they are low income, they will have access to Medicaid coverage for all of their health needs. So there are many ways. The fact that women, if you're in the individual market, get charged more for your premium just for being a woman, and that's not including coverage for maternity or pregnancy care. That's just insurance without maternity care would be charged more just for being female. That is going to go away. That will no longer be legal. The fact that people with pre-existing conditions will have access to insurance at the same price as everyone else will benefit, again, men and women, but women often have a pre-existing condition, even ones such as being victims of domestic violence or having had a hysterectomy, has kept them from getting insurance in the past, and that will change. So there's so many different ways that all of us are going to benefit, and women in particular are getting some very specific benefits out of this that they need to know about, but we're really grateful that the court is allowing it to move forward.
But Dr. Sissonwood, aren't the bulk of the uninsured, the 50 million Americans that are uninsured, 30 million of whom I think will be brought into mm-hmm. the insurance pool, aren't the bulk of them women and children?
Yes, yes.
I see. So that was the point I was making. And had it been repealed, you'd still have 50 million people uninsured. And then on top of that, if the Republicans get in and Mitt Romney enacts the Ryan budget as he has promised, the cuts in Medicaid there would add another 30 million to the 50 million. That's my understanding.
Absolutely. And the fact that, I mean, I think it will be very interesting going forward to look and see how the Medicaid expansion rolls out. This is a program where, under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government will pay for an expansion of Medicaid in every state. And the question now, based on the court's ruling, is will every state take that funding to really expand coverage for low-income families? And hopefully they will. Hopefully, you know, to turn away 100% coverage seems foolhardy, and you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. But there may be some states who now choose not to do that Medicaid expansion, and that would have a real disproportionate effect on families, low-income families, and on women and children. And it's a really unfortunate a twist, but hopefully, you know, the people in each state will realize that expansion really benefits communities and families, and therefore will move forward in expanding that kind of coverage as well. So I think there's, if you go in the opposite direction, which you were suggesting, cuts in Medicare, cuts in Medicaid, that this would really devastate the not just the safety net that we have now, but the fact that our seniors and families really need health insurance, and to start cutting away with what we have now just seems completely in the wrong direction, and hopefully that won't happen.
Well, the Supreme Court ruled against the idea that the government would punish states for opting out in terms of expansion of Medicare. But my understanding is that there are many other ways that the federal government can incentivize these states to get real.
And I'm sure, well, the fact there, the big, you know, the obvious incentive is that this is a 100% coverage by the federal government. It will not cost the states anything for the first few years, and then not very much, 10% of the total sort of forever. And so to get that kind of coverage for a state's population is a huge incentive for a state, I would hope. And again, I hope that clearer minds will prevail in making those decisions and won't be just a political pushback. And other incentives, certainly the health professionals and hospitals and other institutions inside a state would really want to see that happening, that expansion happen, and so hopefully it will.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Susan Wood, do you think that this will solve the fiscal problem here, that we spend more than any other country in the developed world on health care with the least successful outcomes and the least percentage of our population covered? And one of the things that was the impetus behind it was the fact that health costs are just huge budget busters. They're the biggest driver of our deficit. Do you see any hope in that regard? That is this because they did go the insurance route. They didn't go the single payer route, which really would have saved some serious money, but seemed politically impossible.
Right, and I would say I'm hopeful, but this is really just a first step in that direction, and certainly the roles of both ensuring high quality and bringing down costs and putting in systems in place that will encourage care that isn't just high quality care and isn't just, you know, the fee for service model. Those things are part of this law, and we'll see how they play out. And I hope and expect that they would have an impact on the overall cost, and that's certainly what the Congressional Budget Office has estimated, that this will save money. Will it bring us down to, you know, other nations who get better quality for lower costs? We'll wait and see. I think this was not, in my view, you know, the ideal way to go. This was a compromise. This was just taking the insurance route. It wasn't a Medicare for all or other single payer type, or and didn't even offer the sort of public option, which would provide a Medicare like option for people to choose before they turn 65. And so I think we'll see. You know, I think there are improvements, obviously, that can be made that can strengthen both the quality and the cost issues. But this is a huge step forward. And the fact that states are going to begin to implement this program, people are going to start getting better insurance coverage than they already have. And those that don't have it are going to get it at a reasonable price. This is a very momentous day. Very, very good news.
Well, just in closing, you know, the U.S. is spending more than 16% of its GDP on health, and the other countries spend around 9%. So that tells the story.
Your point is absolutely correct.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Susan Wood.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Susan Wood, who's a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She's a professor of health policy and of environmental and occupational health and the executive director of the Jacobs Institute for Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Now let's turn to Paul Starr, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. He's also the co-editor with Robert Kuttner and co-founder with Robert Kuttner and Robert Reich of The American Prospect. His book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine, won the 1984 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, as well as the Bancroft Prize. In 1993, he was a senior advisor for President Bill Clinton's proposed healthcare reform plan, and his latest book is Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Starr.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And what do you think of today's news?
I think it's a miraculous decision. Miraculous because no one, I think, really expected that Anthony Kennedy would vote to overturn the law in its entirety and John Roberts, the Chief Justice, would vote to save it. That is the unexpected turn of events that really just no one, I think, fully anticipated. You read the Roberts opinion, and almost all of it validates the conservative arguments. The Chief Justice does not accept the view that the Interstate Commerce Clause or the Necessary and Proper Clause justify the Affordable Care Act. But instead, he does come to the view that the taxing power justifies the penalties and then goes on to uphold the rest of the law, except with one minor respect, and that's that has to do with the Medicaid provisions. But I initially thought, well, you know, the law survives, but there's a lot that conservatives have to celebrate here. But as I have looked at it more closely, I think this is really quite a substantial liberal victory. The doctrinal gains that conservatives have on the Commerce Clause, the limitations that are enunciated in Roberts' opinion, are not likely to be very relevant to anything else. So I don't think they're really going to matter in the long run. And the same with the Medicaid provisions. Well, that may be more complicated, but there's really a tremendous amount for those of us who've been fighting for universal health care for a long time. There's a lot to be happy with here.
And in terms of the Medicaid provisions, the 5-4 decision on that was basically saying that the federal government doesn't have the ability to punish the states if they don't go along with this new law. Now,
let me explain. Okay, what the opinion says is that the federal government cannot punish states by withholding all of the Medicaid money, including the money for Medicaid as it previously existed before this law was passed. But in all the history of Medicaid, going back to the beginning in 1965, the federal government has never refused to continue financing one state because of some disagreement about implementation of the law. This is not a power that the federal government has ever exercised. So losing this power is really not of great consequence.
But what about using the power to incentivize the states? You know, a number of attorney generals, almost half of the states, wanted to opt out. What incentives are there with these new insurance exchanges to have them join the pool?
Okay, those are two different things, the insurance exchanges and the Medicaid provisions.
Sure.
So Medicaid at the beginning in 1965 was voluntary for the states. It still is voluntary. But although there was some resistance, Arizona didn't have a Medicaid program until 1983, but all the states came in because there's a tremendous financial incentive for the states to take the federal money that is on offer. And in the case of this new Medicaid extension, 100% of the costs are going to be paid by the federal government for the first 3 years, and then it goes down to 90%. That's an incredibly good deal for the states. And really, it takes some governor like Rick Scott in Florida, or maybe Rick Perry in Texas, to say no to this. I expect that sooner or later, all the states will come in and expand Medicaid the way this law proposes.
Again, I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning Princeton's professor of sociology, Paul Starr, who was a senior advisor to the Clinton healthcare reform plan. His latest book is Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. And the struggle, of course, will go on. The House is voting on July the 8th, a symbolic vote against so-called Obamacare. And candidate Romney came out against it today, saying the first thing he'd do if he's elected president was repeal it. The assumption is he doesn't really want to run on talking about health care because of his link to Massachusetts and so-called Obamacare. The battle is certainly not over. But it seems now that what's incumbent upon the president is to start selling this thing, because in the vacuum, hundreds of millions have been spent demonizing and demagoguing so-called Obamacare, and all of the fuss over the individual mandate was completely blown out of proportion, because that's only affects about 8% of the insurance pool.
So only actually about 7%. Would be affected by the mandate, but the estimate actually is that only about 4 million people, that's just a little bit over 1% of the population, would pay the penalties that the Chief Justice says amount to a tax. So this is not a tax on the general population as it is being represented by the Republicans. This is a tax that would fall on a relatively small number of people who don't buy insurance, even though they can afford it. Afford it in the sense that you'd only pay the penalty if, after subsidies, health insurance would cost less than 8% of your income. So that's the criteria in the law, and the mandate is just not the big terrible thing that it's been held out to be.
So what about the deficit then on the Democratic side and the White House side in selling this? And a lot of the benefits are backloaded till 2014.
Yeah. I mean, if there's one thing that I would have liked to see changed in the legislation to begin with, it was the slow timetable for carrying out the major provisions, the provisions that extend coverage to more than 30 million people. I would have liked to see an arrangement, which we actually had in the Clinton health plan, an arrangement called a rolling start, where states could have come in early that were eager to carry out the law. And I think we would have seen states like Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, and maybe California that would have done this more quickly to be able to get the federal money sooner. And then we'd actually now have states that had carried it out by the time of the 2012 election. And, you know, it would, I think, very substantially change the whole way the public looks at it.
So the president today, Paul Starr, he said that people would not need to hang their fortunes on chance. And he pointed out the insecurity and pain that so many people felt about health insurance, not being able to afford it, postponing any medical tests and visits often until it's too late. And that, I think, is the heart of what is sort of cruel and dysfunctional about our healthcare system. So what would you ask from the president now, given the latest polls indicate that most Americans still are against so-called Obamacare? And I think the reason why largely they're against it is that they don't know anything about it or know little about it. And, of course, there would be that core of Tea Party conservatives who'd be against it in any case. So just walk us through what the president needs to do here.
Well, I think now the president should feel much more confident about going out and defending the law and explaining the law. I think the White House probably held back in recent months waiting for this Supreme Court decision because it wouldn't want to have put too much on this legislation if the court had struck it down entirely. That would really be counterproductive. But now I think the president should go out and he should highlight the many different benefits that people will have. And really, it's all those millions of people out there who have some kind of chronic illness, have some member of their family who've been sick with some disease, and you know, either they can't get insurance or they're paying a huge amount for it, or they're stuck in a job and afraid of starting a new business because it's impossible to get health insurance with their medical history. I mean, it's all those people out there, who it's just a huge number of people, who should now really feel more confident and should really rise to support of this legislation.
Well, of course, in a political sense, it completely undercuts so much of the Republican argument against this president, where they've accused him of being a Muslim and a Kenyan and a fraud, etc. That underlying idea that he has no legitimacy, this ruling, of course, has given his signature achievement the legitimacy of a conservative Supreme Court.
Yes, yes. Well, let's also remember, though, there were four justices on that court who voted to overturn it altogether. So, actually, I think that's another reason for Obama to seek support. I mean, this was really very close, and one of the key questions for the next 4 years is going to be who is going to be nominating the new Supreme Court justices, because if that conservative majority, if that conservative minority of four gets one more vote, they are ready to take the court in a very radical direction.
Well, Paul Starr, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Starr, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. He's also the co-editor with Robert Kuttner and co-founder with Robert Kuttner and Robert Reich of The American Prospect. And his book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine, won the 1984 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, as well as the Bancroft Prize. And in 1993, he was a senior advisor for President Bill Clinton's proposed health care reform plan. His latest book is Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar Struggle Over Health Care Reform. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Maria Elena Durazo, the Executive Secretary Treasurer of the LA County Federation of Labor. She is leading a she is leading the largest demonstration ever against Walmart in Los Angeles.
Once was a union maid, she never was afraid of the goons and the ginks and the company finks and the deputy sheriff that made the raid. She went to the union hall when a meeting it was called. When the company boys come around, she always stood her ground. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Maria Elena Durazo, who's Executive Secretary Treasurer of the LA County Federation of Labor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Maria Elena Durazo.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
We're going to do great this Saturday with this largest anti-Walmart, anti-poverty jobs action ever taken in LA.
So this is Saturday in Los Angeles, downtown, to protest the Walmart building a superstore in Chinatown. What I find extraordinary about this is that the LA City Council voted 13-1 to stop this, but it came a day later after Walmart had secured building permits the day before. So how did that happen?
Well, exactly. And that's what our point is in asking all elected officials is we want transparency and we want to take away the whole notion that Walmart can grease, you know, the wheels of politics in order to get approvals for their stores. Walmart is engaging in an extremely aggressive strategy and plan to massively increase the number of stores in the LA urban area. They have been unsuccessful up until now. And, you know, their national average of density is about 21%. If they build 21% of stores in an LA area, that would be over 200 Walmart stores in the LA area. We can't handle that because we can't handle that they would destroy family and small businesses. We can't handle that because that would create more poverty-level jobs and an incredible burden on taxpayers to pay for health benefits, health insurance, because Walmart doesn't do it for its own employees. We can't handle it. That's why we have to stop Walmart.
So, Maria Elena Durazo, the Executive Secretary Treasurer of the LA County Federation of Labor, did some money change hands here? Did George Yu, the president of the Chinatown Business Improvement District, is welcoming it? By the way, Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa is attending a Summer Night Lights job fair for young people that the Walmart philanthropy division gave an $800,000 grant to. Is there a connection there?
Well, look, there's a connection when Walmart gives millions of dollars to elected officials. There's a connection because that's how, they did it through outright bribes in Mexico, the allegations of outright bribes in Mexico. But their whole notion is they want to open these stores no matter what. But today I'm proud to say that the two leading candidates for the next mayor of Los Angeles, both Wendy Gruhl and Eric Garcetti, I'm proud to say, have made the pledge of not taking any money from Walmart. So that's a good start. We have elected officials like Congresswoman Judy Chu, who's not only not taken the past, but she pledges not to do in the future. We need our elected officials, and that's why we put the challenge out to them not to take any money, and if they have, to give it back, because we don't want our political process tainted by Walmart's money.
So tell us about what's going to happen on Saturday in Los Angeles. A rally begins at the Los Angeles State Historic Park in Chinatown, north of Chinatown, called the Cornfield. And take us from there, Maria Elena Durazo.
Well, first of all, we have sisters and brothers coming from even outside of Los Angeles. We have sisters and brothers coming all the way from San Francisco and San Jose, from Orange County, all coming in. We have community-based organizations, immigrants' rights-based, African-American churches and church leaders. We have, it's a very, very big, broad coalition who stand for the same thing. We want good jobs, and we want our small businesses to thrive. And so we will gather at the Cornfields Park area with a very short, with music there. And then we will march about 3/4 of a mile through Chinatown to Broadway near Cesar Chavez Boulevard, where we have above us the dragons to obviously symbolize not only the community of Chinatown. We also have behind us the City Hall business and City Hall chambers. Behind us to show that we also expect City Hall to support the community. Ben Harper will be performing when we reach the main stage. Tom Morello will be performing. We'll have Walmart workers. We will have international union presidents. We will have Chinatown community leaders. We will have leaders of the various workers in the whole supply chain, from the Teamsters to the longshore workers. We have Dolores Huerta, who, of course, just received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. We have Congresswoman Judy Chu. So we have the whole breadth of high-ranking leaders, as well as entertainment industry, as well as our local community leaders.
And this starts at 11 o'clock on Saturday in Los Angeles, in downtown Los Angeles. 10,000 marchers, including the Chinatown line dancers, Korean drummers, motorcycles, families and children, going through the streets of Chinatown, holding up giant banners and thousands of signs condemning Walmart's arrival in Los Angeles. It's been successfully kept out of Los Angeles for decades. Maria Elena Durazo, again, the Executive Secretary-Treasurer of the L.A. County Federation of Labor, I take it that your main objection is that they put a lot of small businesses out of work, out of business, and that they pay non-union slave wages. That's the high cost of low wages. A film was made about Walmart.
Right, and they put the burden on taxpayers. You know, our social services don't need, they're already being cut back and cut back. And Walmart brings a greater burden on taxpayers because they actually, you know, distribute and encourage the employees to sign up for public assistance and for Medi-Cal. I mean, it's outrageous that a corporation that is the largest private sector corporation in the world would put such a burden on taxpayers. So we don't want that. We want good jobs. And that's why we're going to be out there in a very broad coalition. And we ask everybody to join us, take the trains into town, take the buses, drive, take your bicycles, whatever it takes. But join us. We're going to make this the largest rally against poverty jobs, against Walmart's business model, and for good jobs for Los Angeles area.
Well, I think if any American cares about the disparity of wealth in this country between the 99% and the 1%, it's worth noting that yesterday on the floor of the Senate, Senator Bernie Sanders pointed out that the six heirs to the fortune of Walmart's founder, Sam Walton, today own more wealth than the bottom 30% of all Americans.
That's right. And what we want is, it is about Walmart, but it's about what Walmart represents. It's the 1% that hurt the 99%. It's about, you know, anybody else who thinks that's the model to follow, to say no. We want, you know, we're taking the message out about Verizon. We don't want Verizon, you know, to be the Walmart of the communications industry, and, you know, or Hyatt Hotels to be the Walmart of the hotel industry. But this is what's taking place in various industries, so we want to stop it. Walmart represents the worst of corporations in this country, in this world, and we want responsible corporations to take notice of this.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Maria Elena Durazo.
Thank you, and we'll see you Saturday.
You will, indeed. Again, I've been speaking with Maria Elena Durazo, who is the Executive Secretary-Treasurer of the L.A. County Federation of Labor. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down in a minute.